Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Greetings, Dave.
Greetings.
six mod revival bands. Five of them bona fide, and one a figment of my very occasionally fertile imagination. Can you spot the ringer? All right? Six mod revival bands.
Okay, go on.
Cigarettes. You write these down.
Yeah, better, aren't
I? All right. We've got the Cigarettes.
Ooh.
Small Hours.
Yeah.
Eyes down, no conferring.
Go on.
Squire,
yeah.
Dogtooth. The Risk.
Oh, God.
And The Retreads.
Good grief. The only one I know for definite were real is Squire.
That's right, they were.
They were real.
Yes, I know them too, actually.
The Cigarettes, The Risk, Dogtooth. Well, I thought that was a tailoring reference. But it's actually houndstooth check they talk about, don't they? Not dogtooth.
I think you'll find you're wrong there. It's a mod clothing pattern, dogtooth.
I thought it was houndstooth.
No, they call it dog tooth.
Oh, okay. So that may be real, or it may be you making it up. I'm going to say The Risk are made up.
The Risk. Do you know, I feel bad now, though. I've talked you out of it. It is dog tooth. It is dog tooth. But I was looking at mod clothing, and dog tooth came up, a lot of dog tooth pattern. And I thought it sounded a bit like a band trying too hard to be.
Well,
it sounds like
it sounds like a heavy metal group, really, doesn't it?
It does
The word dog in it.
I was going to go for the Crombies or the Harringtons or Stay Pressed, but actually, Stay Pressed did exist. There was a group called Stay Pressed.
Was there really?
Yeah, there was. Yeah,
well, that'd be trademark. You wouldn't be allowed to do
that. No.
Okay, I'm coming back at you.
Go on.
Rappers. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Hip hop stars.
Okay.
Okay. Fabulous.
Yep.
Froggy Fresh. Gangsta Boo. Ridiculous.
Ridiculous is brilliant. That's got a Z in it, I assume.
No. And Fabulous. Filthy Rich.
Filthy Rich. Oh, these are brilliant.
So Fabulous. Fabulous.
Froggy Fresh.
Froggy Fresh. Gangsta Boo. Ridiculous. And Filthy Rich.
Okay, Gangsta Boo's got to be real because it's so absurd that it's got to be real. Froggy Fresh, I think, might be equally gauche and daft. Fabulous isn't quite exciting enough to have been something you've made up. Ridiculous is great, as is Filthy Rich. Filthy Rich is the wonderful kind of irony that a lot of rap names have. I'm going to go for Ridiculous.
Yeah,
that's
you're
the
right.
made-up one. Am you're I right?
Right. It's all right.
Oh, my Lord.
It's Pinch from 30 Rock, the Tina Fey series.
Oh, yeah.
They're always talking about, you know, they're fans of a rapper called Ridiculous.
That's
good. That was a great
name. That is a great name.
Like Fabulous, Ridiculous. Okay. Well, I didn't do
What's
very
the
well,
name of the rapper that, I've completely forgotten now, that Jack Black plays?
We'll
come to it in a minute. Yeah. Ridiculous is good.
All the rest are real. Froggy Fresh, Gangsta Boo, Filthy Rich, Fabulous. Yeah, all real. Part, you know, hip-hop, you can't make it up, can you, really?
You can't make it up.
You can't
Froggy
make it
up. Fresh is fantastic.
Talking of hip-hop and things being made up. I've printed this out and I've left it over there. This morning, Kanye West announced that he is withdrawing his attempt to run for president of the United States in this year's election. This is 2 weeks after he announced that he was going to do it. You know. And I just thought, for flakiness. This is a, it's kind of a new world record, isn't it? This, you know, you announce out of nowhere you're going to run for president of the United States, even though everybody knows you can't, you're too late practically, apart from anything else. You know,
far too late.
You have to put in your nomination papers or whatever you have
all
to do.
All we know is you've got the money.
And so he does it. He says he's going to do it. And then 2 weeks later, he goes, no, I'm not going to do it.
I had a look at it and I thought, actually, it's quite hard work. And it doesn't look a lot of fun some of the time. Occasionally you get things wrong. And people don't like you for it.
You think, what is going on in the head of Kanye West? And also, I'll tell you what, the other thing is, there's clearly nobody in his orbit who could go, Kanye, just, this is me, your old mate, your manager or whatever, talking. Not a good idea. Don't do that. You know, it just kind of, I suppose it's social media, isn't it? You know, the kind of wildest ideas just are published straight away, aren't they? You don't have to go through anybody else to do them. They're out there. If you get out of bed thinking you want to run for president of the United States, you do it.
Could he have just randomly tweeted that at 2 o'clock in the morning?
I think he probably did.
With his manager, he probably did.
Well, that's how things are announced nowadays, isn't it? You know, you don't need to go through any intermediaries. So, yeah, that's all the hip-hop news we got for this week.
So, TV, right? Live Aid.
Oh, all right.
Did you watch? I got a text on whatever it was, Friday night, was it, or Saturday night? Friday night, I think, saying, turn on BBC Two, they're rerunning the old doc.
Oh, God.
But you and I were on. And I don't know if you saw any. Did you see any of it?
No.
And I saw the second half. I thought it was quite interesting. You know, a documentary made in 2005 about Live Aid, and the things, you know, various things struck me. One was the extraordinary respect for royalty. Royalty, and I don't know if it was royalty or just Lady Di. I mean, people were so exercised about the royal couple being there. And I think actually the world was just besotted with Lady Di at the time, weren't they? They were enthralled her. Do you remember that she was, there's a bit of news probably made up that she had roller skated down the corridors of Kensington Palace, listening to Duran Duran on her Walkman. And which is the first time anyone really connected a member of the royal family with pop music. She looked like a member of Duran Duran.
We're talking about, what did we talk about? 1985. Okay. She was the most famous person of the 80s, wasn't she?
Yeah. Internationally,
so she was more famous than all the pop stars who were on Live Aid.
Completely, because there's a bit at the beginning which I didn't remember actually, where they film everybody lining up to meet her, and they are so excited, and they're all there. David Bowie's there, Queen's there, you know, everyone's there, and they talk about what it's like, and they say that she was mildly flirtatious with everybody. It's fantastic. It's absolutely brilliant. Bob Geldof changed his slot. He kicked Midge Ure off and told him it was a technical problem. Could he take the early slot and could Midge go on later, just so he could perform in front of Lady Di?
Really?
Yeah. A pretty mean trick, actually. Also, nonsensical, because actually the later slot would have been far better, because the later Live Aid got, the bigger the audience was.
But I suppose
that's another thing we should talk about, the size of the audience.
I suppose also, just one more thing on The Princess of Wales. This is before giving interviews to Martin Bashir. This is before the era that we're in now, where we expect all members of the royal family, apart from Her Madge, to be on the telly all the time talking about their feelings and what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
In 1985, that didn't happen. And so consequently, you know, on the old pop star wisdom is that if you want your mystique to grow, don't talk to the media. Well, she didn't in those days, did she?
She didn't.
She did later.
Yeah.
Once she done it later, you're a lot less, a lot less excited. So if, you know, Prince Harry appears in your front garden, nowadays you draw the curtains, don't you, really?
Wave an angry fist.
Well, it's just not exciting anymore, is it? It's not just me.
No, absolutely.
Whereas in 1985, it kind of was.
It was thrilling.
So, yeah, that's thrilling. Case. So, yeah, the numbers.
There was a thing that I think I said yesterday, I'd seen in the Times, where the Times had printed 40% of the global population watched Live Aid. So I thought, where did they get that from? So I just Googled Live Aid. Of course, they get it from Wikipedia. Wikipedia says that 1.9 billion people, 40% of the global population, watched it in 150 countries. I mean, I can't think of a statistic that is more colossally wrong. 2,000 million people in 150 countries apparently had access to television and simultaneously turned on Live Aid. That's just so far from the truth. I mean, a lot of those countries didn't show it live anyway. They only had edits, didn't they? And
I told you the story about when I went to Ethiopia.
Oh, you did. That's right.
10 years after Live Aid, and was in Tigray, which is the center, the epicenter of the famine. Talking to farmers who'd been young farmers at the time, who remembered the famine, and my translator was a kind of aid worker, and he was Ethiopian, spoke excellent English, and kind of utterly au fait with the whole thing. And I had to put questions through him, and I said, "Can you ask them if they've ever heard of Bob Geldof? I'm just interested." And he turned to me and said, Who's Bob Geldof?
I know.
And I thought, well, if somebody professionally involved in famine relief in the country where it was targeted hadn't heard the name, there you're rather overestimating the kind of shockwaves going through, I don't know, Nigeria or Sudan or South Africa or whatever, at the time.
It's something massively blown up, particularly by this country, because it mostly part of this country. It was run by people in this country and featured people in this country. But I just thought that was so interesting. And the other thing I forgot was the unseemly race between Jagger and Keith Richards to get on the bill. Because you remember the Rolling Stones didn't really exist at this time. We didn't know that then. But the Rolling Stones from 82 to 87 didn't really exist. Mick Jagger kind of effectively left the group. Keith told me this in an interview.
Well,
he put out two solo albums, which didn't.
But they did that album. Dirty Work came out in the middle of that period, didn't it? I think it did. But they certainly were daggers drawn. That relationship.
And then Mick got on the bill with Tina Turner, didn't he? And then he got in the video with David Bowie. And then Keith managed to pole vault right over him into the pole position of finishing the show, for better or worse.
Yeah,
I mean, I thought that was, and the other thing that's extraordinary is the age. You know, the at the time there was a kind of old young hierarchy that existed.
That's the thing.
There was the old guard. Paul McCartney was 43.
Yes.
You know, Mick Jagger was 42. Freddie Mercury was 38. Bowie 37. You thought of those guys, Rick Parfitt 36. You thought those guys as washed up old guard living on borrowed time. It was almost over. And yet, you know, the age difference between them and the Adam Ant was 31. So he was only just very slightly younger than that. And so now, I think if you had a Live Aid tomorrow, unimaginable, but if you did, you know, you'd have Britney Spears at 38. She'd be 38. She'd be virtually, you know, there are Spice Girls who are 48. Kylie Minogue is 52. You know, McCartney is 78 and Jagger's 77. Tom York would be now, he's 52, would be 10 years older than McCartney would have been then. And he would be one of the sort of young guard, wouldn't he? Morrissey is nearly 20 years older than McCartney. Isn't it funny how that kind of, that I think that whole hierarchy has disappeared now. I don't think we think
it
of
has.
The old guard.
Well, you see, in 1985... In 1985, there were kind of two generations, weren't there? There were the ones who were the driving force behind Live Aid were the Geldofs, the Midgeurs, the, you know, Duran Duran's culture clubs and so forth. They're all the people who come, they'd all come along in the late 70s, early 80s, and they appeared to be seizing the world. You know what I mean? And they invited in these washed up old guys.
Yeah.
You know,
knackered old kids.
Crosby,
Stills and Nash. We hadn't even thought about it for years.
You could do a tune, you know, all these people. And of course, the great irony was that the ones who were brought into the fold, the old gits, went on to
stole the show and have had another fabulous 35 years.
Absolutely all
over. Rebooted their careers and ended the careers of a lot of other ones.
Well, also,
Nick Kershaw, Howard Jones, I'm sure their careers haven't, of course, they're still going, but I mean, they were big deals at the time.
But
you
look at the big stars, the younger stars, you know, the kind of the Sardes, you know, people like that.
Yeah.
Do they have any hits after that?
No. I mean, she has pretty solid album sales, doesn't she?
Yeah, I'm sure.
I don't think she goes out and tours or does any kind of live promotion or anything like that. But I mean, she's gone off the radar, hasn't she, completely?
But I mean, just generally, that generation of groups It was kind of, it was as far as they got up. Whereas yeah. it boot, rebooted the 60s, the people who come through in the 60s into, as you say, another 35 years or something. You know, there ought to be a special branch of mathematics devoted to the study of this thing. We talked about it the other week. You know, it's now 50 years since Bob Dylan's self-portrait. It's 50 years since Bob Dylan was washed up. it was all over.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Later period. It's now 50 years.
50 years later. And he's got a number one album.
Bloody record.
Everybody's falling over themselves. How good it is. Which indeed it is. It's fantastic.
It's extraordinary. So, it kind of redrew the mathematics of popular music, didn't it? That whole thing.
And Cat Stevens, what would have happened to him? He was there.
Well, I was talking there. I'm just gonna let something drop here. Cat Stevens, dropped a name. I was talking to Cat Stevens only the other day.
As you do,
about Live Aid, and I said, do you think you could have had another go round, Because for loads of people it was. He said, no, I was on my way out to that point.
But he was there. The point is, he was there.
No, he was there. He was
Wembley Stadium. And you and I saw him. And he was on our schedules. He was actually part of the programme.
Yeah,
he was
gone
in the afternoon. But he didn't do it because he didn't have a guitar and he was going to... What was he going to do?
I can't tell you, Mark. It's copyright information. Courtesy of the Radio Times.
All right.
But, I did say... do you ever think about it? And he's a very kind of, he doesn't live in the material world, does he really? Steve's Yusuf.
Not remotely.
He doesn't look at it in career terms, He said, no, I wasn't bothered, really. I was getting away from that kind of thing. Which, because most people, it would have eaten them up for 35 years since, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would.
I could have gone on there and started all over again.
Oh, you've got to admire him for not caring.
No, absolutely.
So great television. So great television to terrible television.
Oh, right, go on.
David Foster.
Oh, God. Well, I've got
you
to...
You mentioned it to me.
It's Owen Parker, right? A friend who's a musician. He dropped me an email and says, have you seen this David Foster documentary? It's on Netflix. David Foster is a name I kind of vaguely know, but didn't really know much about. And so I watched it in order to learn about him. And if you've ever, like me, wondered who was responsible for all the really terrible overstated ballads that you hate but are really popular.
Really popular. Celine
really
Dion,
popular.
Barbara Streisand.
There's your man.
Air Supply.
There's your man.
Michael Bublé.
Absolutely. All of them. I couldn't believe how many he'd done. And he has, he just has a feel for the terrible taste of the public. He knows exactly where it's based.
I watched a little bit of that documentary because you were telling me about it. It's called Off the Record, isn't it? It's on Netflix.
Oh, well, there you go. Really original title.
Off the Record. Just the most chillingly cold.
Oh.
And, it's soulless and it's about, it's made by people who celebrate the idea that it's about the mechanics of making music. Do you know what I mean? It's about how you produce things and how you get a certain sound and how you manipulate the people you're working with to make something commercial. There's no suggestion that any of this could have any emotional impact at all, is there? Did you get that?
Does it
produce Chicago? And he says to Chicago, okay, well, here's the deal. You want me to produce your record? I'm going to play the bass. I'm going to play the keyboards. I'm going to co-write most of the songs. And I'm going to be dictatorial and you're going to do what I say. And they have to swallow this, and out comes the record. Of course, it's quite successful.
Really successful.
But they all make a point that it doesn't sound like Chicago.
Well,
he couldn't give a monkey's. His job is just to go in there and get the biggest number of people to buy it as possible.
But it's kind of worth seeing because it reminded me of what my frame of reference is. That Celine Dion appears in it. God, this chilling figure, Celine Dion,
and terrifyingly thin.
And she says, "There's only two greats," or something like this.
That's right.
"There's only two greats: David Foster and Quincy Jones." And I think I feel like going, we just hold on, roll their back a second, Celine Dion. Yeah.
What universe are we now living in? There are some others.
Where what scale did you use to come up with that? You know, there's Quincy Jones and David Foster. And I suppose the answer is a scale is just massive commercial success.
It is.
You know, it's as simple as that. There's no question of kind
but that's
of
the kind of yardstick. It's like when people, you know, you read obituaries or somebody's just died, and they always sort of say, Grammy award-winning star. And you just think, is that the most important thing? This person won a Grammy. You know, it's the seal of their commercial success that's the important thing, rather than some fabulous song that might have connected with people.
This film features lots of my least favourite people keep popping up. I think it can only be a matter of time before Clive James comes in. We love Clive James, the late Clive James. I'm thinking it can only be a matter of time before Clive Davis pops up. Sure enough!
Yeah, he's there.
Art pops Clive Davis. Clive Davis, who was chilling. Really chilling. Yeah. And he's the only person... I used to... one of the signs of being a music fan is that you don't just... It's not just what you like, it's what you don't like. And there used to be one record company that I hated. And I actually think I probably still do. Not the record companies really exist anymore. And I used to, I may have a couple of their records on that label behind me there, but they will have been bought, you know, against my better judgment, really. And that is Arista. I always hated Arista. I always felt Arista just had no kind of grit. Arista had no funk. You know, there was no humour in Arista. And Arista, a very successful company in the end, thanks to, I don't know, Barry Manilow and all kinds of things. But, you know, but I just never liked it. And Arista was built in the image of Clive Davis.
Yeah.
And loads of people's careers have been built in the image of Clive Davis. Really successful careers. Whitney Houston, people like that. You know.
Yeah.
Clive Davis does genuinely understand what some people like. But he also, by accident, seems to understand what I loathe. I don't think it's one of his priorities, but it's just a kind of side effect of the whole thing, you know.
You're so right. But the other thing that's talking about that world is there's no humility in it at all.
David Foster
was the least likable person. I'm sorry. But there's a bit where he's telling his own story, and he talks about playing the piano when he's three or something, and he says to his mother, that's an E you're playing there. And he said, he basically says, I was a genius.
Yeah,
I was a musical genius. Now, it's not, mate, it's not for you to say whether you're a genius or not. It's for other people to say that you're a genius and you to be impossibly modest and blushing about it.
None of that with our Dave. No modesty.
Not at all.
No modesty, false or otherwise.
None.
So, you know, if you fancy an evening having your teeth set on edge in front of Netflix, you can't go better. I just watch half an hour of... what's it called? On the Record or Off the Record?
Off the Record. Yeah, it's on Netflix. And it's excruciating.
Yeah.
And as an antidote, surely, go back and listen to some of those early Judy Dibble records.
Oh, right.
Judy Dibble, I mean, you know, what a wonderful...
Well, she died, last week, I think it was, wasn't it?
She did.
And I mean... I didn't really know very much about her. She was the original singer in Fairport Convention.
Yeah.
So first album came out on Polydor and she was the singer. And then...
She'd been to school with Ashley Hutchins,
hasn't she? So she comes from...
So she'd gone to all the...
She went to school very near...
Right around the corner from you, actually, Wood Green and all that.
And
she went to... She then went to all the folk clubs. She met Richard Thompson, with whom she was... Going, I didn't know that she was Richard Thompson's girlfriend.
Well, because Richard Thompson was up the road in Finchley. Ashley Hutchins in Bounds Green. Simon Nicholson. Hill. They're all local around here, so that's how they kind of came together. But between the first album and the second one, she was edged out in a fashion that you don't normally associate with your matey,
your matey old
real ale
quaffing folkies.
No,
you're tree hugging. No, I thought I was a bit shocked.
They got rid of her like David Foster would have got rid of her.
They did. I thought it was so sad. You know, she bravely talks about how I think she just split up with Richard, and they clearly had just met Sandy Denny.
Absolutely,
because Sandy Denny was in 20 minutes after she was out. But then that awful story that she put on her website. She wrote her own very, very good biog. It's really interesting, and how much she had to fly out for the last gig in Rome. Coming back, nobody went to the airport to see her off. There's nobody to meet her when she got home. Can you imagine how you felt kicked out by your old boyfriend and his band going on to great things?
She would have been very young at the time.
God, she would have been about, what, 2021 or something?
Probably not even that old.
She had 3 years of kind of intense activity. You know, after that, she met Giles McDonald, Fripp, and all that lot. And she was in the original King Crimson, wasn't she?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, she records a version of her recording "Talk to the Wind," which you can still get on the internet, which is the second track on the Crimson King album. Right. And so she was right. And then she talked about meeting David Graham and coming around to her flat and how terrifying he was. And, you know, what an odd bloke. And they had a flat, she and her boyfriend in Notting Hill Gate, used to hide when he was around there. But she met absolutely everyone. She recorded with Rod Stewart. She formed a band with Lowell Coxhill. You know, she then, there was the Trader Home, that group.
Trader Horn. But the interesting thing that I never knew, and I only learned when reading about her after she died, was that, well, one of the interesting things was she married Simon Staple. Simon Staple is a name that kind of got completely lost, but was it
Count Simon de la Bedoyer or something?
Whatever.
What was his real name?
Something like that. But he was known in the early days of International Times, sort of 1967, 68, 69, possibly.
Scene maker.
He used to.
Groover.
He reviewed records. And they were known as, reviewed the records in Simon's Stable. Get it? Play on words. Simon's Stable, because his name was Simon Stable. And I used to find it really exciting. Simon Stable has heard the new Blodwyn Pig album, you know, when nobody else knew or cared. And so she married him. And then they sort of withdrew. And didn't she work as a librarian? I think she did.
She was a librarian before, and I think she went back to being a librarian after.
Later in life.
And she retired, and she gave it all up. It's really interesting, because so few people do this. Vashti Bunyan did, actually, come and think of it. Vashti Bunyan was out of it for about 35 years, and then came back.
But well, she had kids, didn't she?
So she did, yeah, exactly the same with both of them, and fair enough. You know, wonderful. They just thought, right, I'm going to go for a completely different life. Mm. And she eventually, Judy Darbo, went back, and I think did something at Crop Reedy with Fairport Convention, and sort of got back into it.
Before. But she and Simon used to run, apparently for quite a long time, a tape duplicating company. And I never knew this. So in the days before CD, when you and I would get sent an advance release tape of the new Boomtown Rats album on an actual cassette, had probably been produced from their company. It was in Northampton or somewhere like that. Because they probably had to have that stuff done by people that trusted. Yeah. They weren't going to sprinkle it around radio stations and, you know, get it bootlegged and so forth. And so they had that business for quite a long time. And then she came back and, as you say, and had a bit of an Indian summer in terms of attention, because that's the interesting thing to me, that there's been a lot of comment, you know, post her death, and the very little comment 40, 50, 60 years ago. You know what I mean? It just shows how interested all that area has grown and grown and grown over
Completely.
The years. Which is amazing.
Whole new generations of people going back and listening to all those records.
Multiple generations of people.
Yeah.
So, yes, sad for her.
So a book I read.
God,
which I recommend, Shellac and Swing by Bruce Lindsay.
Oh, right, yeah.
Very, very good. This guy, Bruce Lindsay, has written a book about, well, it's about shellac. It's about the story of the gramophone.
Right.
And it starts in the late 19th century with the invention of recording, smoked paper, followed by the wax cylinder, and then eventually the shellac recording through the kind of, through the funnel directly through the needle and onto the disc, you know. And I discovered just all sorts of interesting things. One is that you kind of think of the idea of portable music as being something quite recent. You know, in my case, it was the battery-operated record player. You click back the arm. Do you remember those? Came out in the mid-60s.
Oh, yeah.
And sit in a field and play Blonde on Blonde. You thought, this is the most amazing thing. I'm playing the music I want to hear in the place I want to hear it at the time I want to hear it, you know. But I mean, otherwise, it's really the cassette and it's the iPad, you know, seem to have kind of changed the thing. But in fact, there were portable gramophones. Programmers in the very early 20th century.
Well, you see, I
read a story about this woman who swims the channel called Lily Smith. And she swims the channel, and in the book he says that she sustained herself physically with beef tea, grapes, and rice pudding, and with a gramophone on her pilot boat, which played exhilarating tunes as she swam.
You see, that's the beauty of the wind-up gramophone, is it was wind-up. You didn't have electricity. So, you know, that Bertie Wooster or, you know, characters in Brideshead Revisited would take a gramophone, you know, to go and lie down by the river, wouldn't they, and have a picnic and play a few records because they could just wind it up, you know, whenever
the original
needs.
Dixieland jazz band or something.
Yeah.
No, it's great. And there's another interesting thing. It talks about the first DJ, and I think you know about this guy, a guy called Christopher Stone.
Oh, right, yeah.
Generally thought of as being the first DJ. Wireless was invented in 1920, and in 1927, the BBC started, I think, in 22 or something. And in 27, he's given his own show. And the idea is that it's billed as a recital of gramophone records arranged by Mr. Christopher Stone. Mm-hmm. And this is a sort of chummy old song. He said, I grew up, you might say, with a song in my heart. And there's this kind of amiable chat in between the records. And that becomes the first actual kind of DJ show. And it's so successful that he went off and started to perform live. So he did a whole week at the London Palladium, where he took the stage and topped the bill with various comedians underneath it. And his thing was just playing records, you know. At one point, he played a record backwards. I'm not quite sure what the point of this was, but it was La Donna e Mobile by Caruso. He plays it backwards, you know, to prove the wonderful versatility of the record player. I love that, though. He had 12,000 discs. And I think he's genuinely thought of as being the man who invented the concept of DJing. Not only DJing live and out there, you know, on the circuit, but doing his own program on the radio.
Talking about mobile music, funny thing happened to me yesterday.
Go on.
I went, as you know, for the first time in over 4 months, into the West End of London. That was my great adventure. I've just been craving to go into the West End of London, just to see what it was like, you know. I know you went earlier on during lockdown. You went on your bike. Well, I don't.
I've been all over London on my bike.
I'm a bit too far away to do that. But anyway, so I took by a combination of overground train and Shanks's pony. I got into the West End, and I was walking down Jermyn Street on my way back to take a book back to the library. And I thought, it's really unusual sound in Jermyn Street. It's a busker. Because busking in Jermyn Street, they keep a very tight ship down there. And buskers nowadays, you know, they announce themselves by the sound of amplified music, don't they? It's not a warm little acoustic sound, is it? It's a booming kind of, you know, ignore me if you dare kind of over-amplified thing. And I thought, is this happening down Jermyn Street? Well, I'll walk a bit faster and get away from it. And it just... this music kept up with me, and I walked down to St. James's Square, and it was still keeping up with me. This music, I was getting really kind of cross, really. And I turned around, and there's some person I can only describe as a twat. he's walking down the street, middle of the day. He's wearing a suit. He's carrying some sort of, you know, 21st century descendant of the boombox. He's playing some horrible kind of, I don't know, sub Ed Sheeran singer-songwriter. Who's he doing that for crying out loud? And why can't he do it for himself, you know?
Why can't he put the phones on?
Physically assault him, you know?
Did you have a word? You see, you can't have a word with something like that, because part of the reason they're doing it is that they want you to have a go, and they've got some prepared answer which they're going to unleash.
Or worse than a prepared answer.
That's true.
That was the low point of my adventure in the West End yesterday.
But how thrilling, because you did nearly 12 miles, didn't you? You walked 12 miles.
I walked 12 miles. I went into a record shop. I went and bought a book at, Daunt's in Marylebone High Street. And, I came back, I was absolutely exhausted, as you can imagine.
As you would be after 12 miles.
It's ridiculously...
I worked out that's the same as walking from your house in Old Southgate to Wembley Stadium. That's a long way.
Yeah, that would be considerably less pleasant, that journey, because it'd take you a long time, the North Circular, which I wouldn't recommend to anybody. But anyway, so I've satisfied my curiosity about the West End. I shall go back then. I think I'll return, because shops, I mean, they've got staff in them, you know, and they're just looking out the window, you're looking out the door, you know, casting, you know, sort of flirtatious looks at potential shoppers. Please, God.
Giving you the come on. Give me the finger.
And just, you know, buy something, anything, you know. And I've got great sympathy for them. Maybe
there's pubs around here. Pubs are open, but there's nobody really in them. Maybe that's just because Chiswick in West London isn't the kind of most hopping part of the world in terms of...
I really felt like I was disappearing into a pub and having a pint against.
The Word Podcast, walking the digital dog since 2007.
We should mention before we go that we did Graham Parker. We talked to Graham Parker from Word in Your Attic the other day.
We did.
Was fantastic, I thought. Fantastic.
It was terrific. Well, we also did Will Birch this week, didn't we? Did we mention
He's also extremely good.
They've all been wonderful.
But I thought Graham Parker was so many good bits in it, not least the bit where he's talking about scaring off bears with fireworks in his garden. He lives in the Catskills. That's great. Which makes it seem a bit tame living around here. But there's a bit where he talked very movingly about it. He said, I think I'm retired now. I can't imagine I'm ever going to tour again. And part of me doesn't miss it. And he talked about the business of going to sound checks. I thought it was very moving.
Yeah,
You've just no idea what it's like arriving time after time, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, in some kind of gloomy, sticky hall, or floored...
Smell of last night's beer.
Smell of old beer. That's right, you know, and having to sit there and try out the microphones. He said, often on your own or with your driver or whatever, you know. But he said, it's a very dispiriting thing. And I thought that was really well put, you know. And it just reminded me of Nick Lowe talking about trying to enliven the whole touring process. And he said he had this wonderful game. I think I've told this before. This wonderful game that when they were on the tour bus, particularly going around America, what they do before they set off is that they would go out and they would put a colour or their initials on the wheel hub, the wheel nut on the hub of one of the wheels on the front of their tour bus. Right, so they'd write their name in it on a colour. That was their nut. And they would put their marker on it. Then they'd all put $20 in a hat, and when they got to the venue, they would rush out, and the person whose nut was closest to the venue won all the money. Don't you think that's fantastic? Is that a brilliant way of kind of just generally keeping the old balloon in the air?
Oh dear, right.
You're sitting there on this long and interminable journey, you think, well, at the end of all this, I could still be winning $160. Great. It's good, isn't it?
It really does stress how absolutely everything apart from the show is unbelievably boring, isn't it?
Yeah.
The people who just do it all the time. Not exciting. All the kind of things that we as kind of dilettantes find exciting.
Yeah.
They just can't
see the job. The hotels, the hanging around, the meeting people. None of that.
The sense of impermanence. We like that.
Yeah.
Because it's a change from our normal life. Whereas for them, it's, oh, God, why would anybody want to do that? Has it done it a million times? Yes, yes. So, well, anyway, will it ever come back in the light of...
There's a great piece in Rolling Stone where there's lots of people talking about it, and Bruce Springsteen and people, and they all talk about it. And you think, well, it's nothing to do with the money. You know, it's to do with it's their livelihood. It's the structure. It's a central structure. It's what they do for a living. It's what they are.
Well, it's like we've said millions of times, haven't we, on this podcast, that people ask, why do people keep on doing it? And the reason they keep on doing it is if you could keep on doing it, you keep on doing it.
You could keep on doing it.
Because it's a reason for living, isn't it?
Completely.
And if you're Bruce Springsteen, in the end, what is Bruce Springsteen's most significant talent? Is it to write songs? No. Is it to play guitar? No. Is it to sing? No. His overriding talent is he can light up a room like nobody else.
Yeah.
And once you can't do that anymore, that must be really upsetting.
Really, I think so. And he's sitting there thinking, we just don't know. That's the big problem. We're completely uncertain of what the future's going to hold. And that must be hard.
Very, very hard. Very hard.
Two new patrons, Dave.
Okay.
We just mentioned. Yep. A.V. Chowdhury.
Right, hello.
Andrew David Nelson. Thank you very much.
Nice to
meet you. We should mention, actually, we did our first birthday recording the other day with one of our subscribers, Alan Williams. Who was terrific.
Oh, we did.
A little erratic with him. He was great.
So if you're on the right level at Patreon, we could be doing the same for you come your birthday, whenever that is. And we've got the usual quiz on Friday night, 6 o'clock quiz on Friday night. See how you can climb the leaderboard by engaging in completely empty tests of your command of pop music trivia. Sad, I know, but it keeps us all going.
We like it.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.